This is Mayo Clinic Radio, the only show that gives you the chance to ask your questions to Mayo Clinic experts. We'll take you beyond the headlines to explain what developments in medicine mean to you. Join the conversation by phone, Twitter, Facebook, or radio.mayoclinic.org. Now, with this week's program, here are your hosts, Dr. Tom Shives and Tracy McRae.
From the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota campus, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Welcome, everyone, to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Well, Tracy, the weather is getting better
here in
Minnesota, believe it or not. But it's still Saturday, and we need to talk about another medical problem. And this week, it is stroke. And did you realize that strokes disable more Americans than any other disease, any other condition? That includes back pain and depression. And that's true worldwide. Stroke is far and away the most frequent cause of disability around the world. Now, for most people, strokes happen when the blood supply to the brain gets blocked. Sort of like a heart attack of the brain. A blood vessel gets blocked up, usually because of hardening of the arteries or atherosclerosis. And that part of the brain that's supplied by the blood vessel that gets blocked actually dies if you don't do something about it. And there is also another kind of stroke, and it's called a hemorrhagic stroke or a bleeding stroke. And that kind of stroke can cause just as much damage. And sometimes it is the result of an aneurysm or a bulging of the artery that then ruptures, and then the blood gets out into the brain, and there's not much room for anything in the brain other than the brain. And so then that causes damage. But that's why aneurysms are an important consideration. So two kinds of stroke: the hemorrhagic stroke, where there's a bleed into the brain, and the kind of stroke that's similar to a heart attack, where a blood vessel gets plugged up.
Sure.
It's also important to know that there are certain people who are at higher risk for a stroke. People with high blood pressure, people with diabetes, high cholesterol, even obesity. But it's also important to know that one out of five people who have a stroke, 20% of people who have a stroke, don't have any risk factors. A stroke can happen to anybody, even you or me.
That's one of the most impressive parts of what you just said.
Right.
No symptoms whatsoever, no risk factors.
No matter who you are, no matter whether you have risk factors or not, stay tuned.
Today on Mayo Clinic Radio, we'll talk with two stroke experts. Neurologist Dr. Robert Brown of Mayo Clinic Rochester is joining us once again, and by telephone, neuroradiologist.
That means that he is a specialist in imaging the brain and the spinal cord.
All right.
Neuroradiologist.
Well, Dr. David Miller is a neuroradiologist from Mayo Clinic Jacksonville, and he's going to join us. We'll also talk about the symptoms and the warning signs of a stroke, one of the most important parts of this program. We'll talk about what causes them, who's at risks. We'll talk to Dr. Miller specifically about the bleeding type of stroke and the aneurysm. Plus, treatment of stroke, including why a stroke is a medical emergency, and we'll tell you what you can do to lower your risk for stroke. There's lots of important things on that list that you can do starting today. But first, one of the most exciting health stories of the entire year happened this week.
I think that's true. With us, Dr. Stephen Russell.
Yes, that's right. It has to do with multiple myeloma and a virus. What are we going to do here, Dr. Stephen Russell? Tell us all about how we're going to cure multiple myeloma. Is that the plan?
Or at least you've done it once.
That's
right.
Tell us about it.
That is the plan. And before I tell you about that, I should say that 5 years ago, I had a stroke and made a complete recovery. So,
wow.
No, you're kidding.
Yep.
And you're young.
I had great treatment at Mayo Clinic. I was very fortunate to be in the right place. So, really? Yeah.
So you had a stroke, you realized you were having a stroke, you went to the hospital, they stopped the stroke, and you had a complete recovery.
Yeah, I've had a complete recovery. Took a while, took a couple of years to fully recover function, but it was, yeah.
Well, thank goodness, now look what you've done.
Yeah, Dr. Russell, tell us how the measles virus is going to help in fighting multiple myeloma.
Okay, so everybody, I think, understands how viruses can cause damage in the body. Viruses, they come in the air or the water, and they attack, depending on which virus it is, they attack a different part of the body. So the flu virus will attack the lungs, hepatitis virus will attack the liver, the AIDS virus will attack the immune system. And so the idea here is to use viruses to specifically attack a cancer. And in this case, we've used the measles vaccine, but we're not using it as a vaccine. We're using it as an anti-cancer weapon, and we are giving enormous doses of this vaccine virus into the bloodstream so that it seeks out and infects and destroys only the cancer cells in the body. And the cancer that we're treating in this case is multiple myeloma. And multiple myeloma is a form of blood cancer that lives in the bone marrow throughout the body, and which also forms fairly large tumors that can destroy the bone. And we've been developing measles as a therapy for this condition for quite some time. And, you know, we have a large number of different teams at Mayo Clinic contributing to this work. But to cut to the story of our famous patient now, Stacey Erholtz, she's had myeloma for about 10 years, and she's had all kinds of therapy. She's had two stem cell transplants, she's had Velcade, and she's had Revlimid, and she's become resistant to all those therapies. And then in May of last year, she came to the clinic with a golf ball-sized tumor growing on her forehead that had destroyed the underlying bone and which was also compressing her brain.
Yeah.
And in addition to that, we did a PET CT scan, and she had five other similar tumors elsewhere in her body, in her sternum and her clavicle and her spine, and another one in her skull. And we put a needle into the bone marrow, and we found that there were diffusely infiltrating the bone marrow with these plasma cells everywhere.
The cancer cells, the myeloma cancer cells.
Yeah, yep. They were everywhere. And she was pretty much out of options. You know, she'd gone through all standard therapies for myeloma, and she had heard that we were doing this measles study at Mayo Clinic, and so she requested that she be enrolled in the study. And she was the second patient to receive the top dose of the virus. The way the study had been going, we'd been gradually increasing the dose. Every three patients that we treated, we'd then go to a higher dose. And we hadn't really seen any activity against myeloma. But now we're at the top dose level. We were hopeful, and she was the second patient. And we set up the drip. We gave her the virus. Within 5 minutes, she had a terrible headache. We stopped the infusion. We gave her some Benadryl. The headache went away, and she said, "Carry on, finish it off." We were ready to stop at that point. It's kind of scary, you know.
How much measles vaccine were you giving her?
Well, it's the equivalent of 10 million doses of the vaccine.
That's a bad case of the measles.
It's an enormous dose. And it's because we're not using it as a vaccine, you know.
Right, yeah. Right.
So in it went, and she felt fine after the infusion stopped. But then about 2 hours later, she started shaking, and her temperature went up to 105, and she was vomiting. And, you know, we had to use cooling blankets and everything to bring it down. But over the next few days, these fevers recurred, but they settled pretty quickly. And then within 36 hours of getting the virus, she said that the tumor on her forehead, which her children had actually given a name, Evan, Evan started to shrink. And over the next 6 weeks, Evan completely disappeared. And her blood work improved. There's a cancer marker that was present in her blood, a myeloma cancer marker. And that disappeared. And we repeated the bone marrow test, and the bone marrow was clear of myeloma cells. And we repeated the PET CT scans, and there was no detectable myeloma in her body for quite a long time. So a single intravenous administration of this virus led to complete resolution of her myeloma. And the importance of this, I mean, it's an absolutely historic moment for the field of oncolytic virus therapy, because people have been using viruses, attempting to use viruses to treat cancer for a long, long time. Ever since viruses were first grown in the lab in the 1950s, people have been trying. And this is the first time ever that an intravenously administered virus has caused resolution of a disseminated cancer in a person. So,
so what's next? I'm sure your phone is ringing off the wall. What's next?
Well, what's next is we've got to prove that this is not a fluke. We're pretty certain it's not a fluke because we have another patient who we reported in our paper in the Mayo Clinic Proceedings, which was published just this week, a second patient who had a response to the virus given in the same way, but it was a more short-lived response. And we, in that patient, there was quite a bit more myeloma in her body, and we think that if we'd been able to take the dose a little higher, we would have had a better outcome.
So do you think 10 million, the dose of equivalent to 10 million doses, is that going to need to be even bigger, or have you topped off at 10 million?
We haven't topped off, actually, because we have not yet seen what we call dose-limiting toxicity. But, you know, the purpose of these early-stage trials from the perspective of FDA is to determine what the maximum safe dose is for the therapy. And so we could actually go higher. And it may be that that will be something we do. The problem is the manufacturing of the virus is our limitation. You can imagine that to make that sort of quantity of a virus is a big deal. And we're very fortunate at Mayo. You know, we have our own manufacturing facility, and we have an extraordinary team of people running that facility. But Dr. Federspiel, Mark Federspiel, is the person running it. But they have been able to produce about 1,000 times more concentrated virus than even Merck. Mm-hmm. And Merck supply the measles vaccine in Europe. So, you know, it really has been quite an extraordinary manufacturing feat to allow us to move up to these high dose levels.
It sounds like you better crank up the measles machine.
cranked up the measles.
And Dr. Russell, I think that maybe you and Stacy might need to come and join us for a full hour of the program sometime very soon.
Well, Stacy would absolutely love to do that, and I would love to be there with her.
All right.
That would be great.
We'll be in touch.
Evan will not be there.
Thanks,
Dr. Russell.
Thank you so much.
We'll take a short break, and then coming up, we'll talk with two stroke experts, Dr. David Miller from the Mayo Clinic, Florida, Dr. Robert Brown, Chairman of the Department of Neurology at Mayo Rochester.
That's kind of just choked me up. That is such an amazing story. Plus, myth or matter of fact, there's nothing you can do to prevent a stroke. Is that a myth or a fact? We'll get the answer coming up. And right after the news at the bottom of the hour, we'll take your questions for our experts at 507-282-1234. You can also go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, and leave a question or tweet us anytime at #MayoClinicRadio. We'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. Dr. Tom Shives, Tracy McRae, and this week's guests, both stroke experts. Dr. Robert Brown in studio. Dr. Brown, good to have you with us.
Good morning.
As always.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So there are lots of things that you don't want to have when it comes to diseases, but stroke is certainly one of those, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a very worrisome disease because, as you mentioned earlier, Tom, it's the number one cause of disability in the United States. It's the number four cause of death in the United States. And so
that's an improvement, though.
It is. It used to be the third leading cause. Now it's dropped to number four, fortunately. And so we are making some inroads, but it's still an extremely worrisome disease.
And May is Stroke Awareness Month. And so that means you get to come back here. Every year you get to come in. But we like having you here because it's an important story. It's an important message that people have to hear.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to come and visit with you because it is clear that despite our efforts over the years, that there is a high proportion of the population that still does not know the symptoms of stroke and does not know the risk factors for stroke. And so anytime we can get the word out, we enjoy doing so, hoping to impact on people and so that if they know the symptoms, they'll come to the emergency room and we might be able to treat them.
And I think actually you having been here in the past may have led to better outcomes of some patients who have listened to our program.
Yeah, interestingly, we did hear a story last year of somebody who had listened to the program a few weeks later, had symptoms, and because they had heard the symptoms of stroke, emergently came to the hospital and was treated. because of they came early enough to be treated.
Now, there are two kinds of stroke, as we alluded to. Just briefly describe those, because in a minute we're going to talk to Dr. David Miller, who's an expert in the treatment of one of these types of strokes.
Mm-hmm. Well, about 85% of strokes are called cerebral infarctions or ischemic stroke. That is a lack of blood supply to the brain. An artery is blocked by a little blood clot or some other material, and that leads to a lack of blood flow. And so the brain cells begin to die off as that oxygen-carrying blood is lacking to that area of the brain. The other type of stroke, about 15%, is a bleeding or hemorrhagic type of stroke. That blood can spill into the brain tissue or over the lining around the brain and lead to damage of the brain in that way.
You know, is that usually the result of a ruptured aneurysm or not always?
Yeah, great question. And taking it one step further, there are two main type of bleeding strokes. One of those two types of bleeding strokes is called a subarachnoid hemorrhage. It's just the location in the brain where the bleeding has occurred. That's most commonly caused by an aneurysm. The other type of bleeding stroke, where the blood is going inside the brain tissue, that's most commonly caused by high blood pressure. So those are the two bleeding types of stroke.
And when we say aneurysm, tell our listeners exactly what we mean by that.
Well, let's bring Dr. David Miller in, because he's on the line.
Oh.
And he can tell us about that, too. Good morning, Dr. Miller.
Good morning. Well, it's hard to speak in deference to such an authority as Dr. Brown, but maybe I can shed a little light. You have two types of vessels in your body that bring blood to the around the body. One's called an aneurysm, an artery, and that brings blood away from the heart. The arteries are real thick-walled things because there's a lot of pressure, but they have a really smooth, thin inner lining. We're all born with little weak spots in the artery, and over time, sometimes the inner lining pushes its way out the side, sort of like an inner tube sticking out of a tire. Mm. So now you have high-pressure blood going out into this little bubble and coming back in, and that's actually what an aneurysm is.
Oh, okay. And if that ruptures, bad news, huh?
That's very bad news. Interestingly, lots of people have these little bubbles, probably 1% to 2% of the population. So if you're in a mall or if you're in a movie theater, somebody has an aneurysm. Obviously, most of the time, they never cause any trouble.
But that's 6 million people in the U.S. that have one of these aneurysms, right?
Exactly. So Lots of people are walking around with these things and never know it and may never need to know it. But unfortunately, if you have a leak or if it ruptures, yes, it's one of the worst things that can happen to you.
Is there a way to know that you have one of these?
Well, it's interesting. We used to be the only way you really knew how to do that was to do an angiogram, which is like a heart catheterization. And that involved putting in a catheter and some risk to the patient, so we didn't do it all the time. The wonderful addition of MRI scanning has actually increased our ability to find these things before they bleed. It used to be, like I said, you would be very careful in asking someone to undergo a catheterization. But, you know, anymore, if anybody has a headache for more than a couple of weeks, they get an MRI. And it's actually a wonderful way to look for aneurysms.
Oh, so that would be the symptom that would lead you to do the MRI that would find the aneurysm, a headache.
There are a number of symptoms, but that's probably the one of the most common ones. The problem, obviously, is that headache is one of the most common things that people get. Most headaches are certainly not related to aneurysms, and I don't want to scare people into thinking that every time they have a headache. But persistent headaches is certainly one of those things that you should talk to your doctor about. If you have a headache every day, if you have a headache every week for more than a few times, then there's something going on. It may not be an aneurysm, but you certainly should talk to your physician about it.
I would think that there's really nothing you can do about this, but I would be wrong, because now there are some new treatments for aneurysms.
There actually are new treatments for aneurysms, and they're very exciting. Traditionally, what has been done, and Dr. Brown can certainly talk to you more about which aneurysms should be treated. Not all aneurysms actually need to be treated, but if we do decide to treat them, there are some new treatments that we think are very exciting. Traditionally, you would do an operation and have to put a little metal clip across the aneurysm. More recently, over the last 15, 20 years, we've been able to try to treat these things from inside. Similarly to in cardiology, where you used to have to do heart surgery to treat all the vessels in the heart, and now the cardiologists go up with catheters and do stents and angioplasty and things. We can actually go up with little catheters, which are little straws about the size of a piece of spaghetti. We can actually go in the aneurysm and put some metal coils in and actually coil the aneurysms from inside. The most recent development, actually in the last year or two, has been something which we call flow diverters. And they're a wonderful new device which can treat these aneurysms even more simply and more safely. It looks a little bit like the mesh in your screen door. It's rolled up like a Tootsie Roll, and you just lay the mesh over the aneurysm. You can decrease the flow enough, and actually very often the aneurysm will go away.
Wow, incredible. Does every one of these need to be treated? If you find it, you treat it?
Well, actually, if I would turn that to Dr. Brown, who really is one of the world's authorities in just that subject.
Well, why talk to you when we've got the world's authority right here?
Oh, no.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Dr. Miller. I appreciate that comment. And when we see somebody with an unruptured aneurysm, there are many factors that go into that decision. The aneurysm size, the aneurysm location, the patient's health, have they had a family history of aneurysm or aneurysm rupture, the overall appearance of the aneurysm. There are all sorts of factors based on the appearance of the aneurysm and the patient's overall situation that leads us to make that decision. And oftentimes a neuroradiologist like Dr. Miller, a neurosurgeon, myself as a neurologist, will put our heads together and make the best decision and recommendation to the patient regarding, do you need to be treated or can we leave it alone? This has maybe been there for a while. Oftentimes we can leave it alone and monitor it.
Dr. David Miller, 30 seconds remaining before our break at the bottom of the hour. Anything you want to add?
Well, I think the main thing I would add to that is we can't do any of that unless we know about it. So I would particularly urge people who know that they have a family history of someone having had a subarachnoid hemorrhage or an aneurysm to just contact their physician and say, hey, is this something that I need to worry about? And more generally, the same things that you do for your heart health, you do for your aneurysm health. So avoiding hypertension, treating it if you have it, not smoking, those are the things that we can all do to avoid this pretty much a very deadly disease.
Dr. David Miller, neuroradiologist at the Mayo Clinic in Florida, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, you're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio. Our guests are both stroke experts, Dr. David Miller, who you've just heard from, and we'll hear more from Dr. Robert A. Brown of the Mayo Clinic in Rochester coming up.
We'll talk. We'll hear this week's health and medical news from Vivian Williams, and after that, we'll take your phone calls at 507-282-1234. Take your comments from our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, and your tweets at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. This is Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams with headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. It seems just about every day more research emerges about the benefits of exercise. Well, for people with kidney disease, walking may help you live longer and reduce your risk of needing dialysis or a kidney transplant. Now, that's from a study in the Clinical Journal of the American Society of Nephrology. Being sedentary is common for people with chronic kidney disease, so researchers designed the study to see if an activity as simple as walking might be good for patients. They found most patients were able to walk if they wanted to, and a minimal amount of walking once a week for less than 30 minutes seemed beneficial, but more frequent and longer walks may be even better. The more patients walked, the less likely they were to die or to need dialysis or a transplant. And in other news, concussions in youth sports are something to take seriously. And Mayo Clinic researchers found an effective and easy way to assess possible concussions on the sidelines. It's an eye movement test. Now, in the study, Mayo researchers assessed high school hockey players using the King-Devick test. That test requires an athlete to read single-digit numbers displayed on cards. After suspected head trauma, the athlete's given that test, which takes about 2 minutes, and the results are compared to a baseline test given before. If the time needed to complete the test takes longer than the baseline test time, the athlete should be removed from play until evaluated by a medical professional. Here's Dr. Amal Starling.
We need to make sure that we have a good way on the sideline, on the bench, wherever the sport is being played, to have a sideline tool that we can use for removing people from play after a suspected concussion.
Now, you've likely heard that the antioxidant resveratrol found in red wine, chocolate, and grapes is good for your health because it helps fight cardiovascular disease, cancer, and inflammation. Well, a study from Johns Hopkins University says maybe not. They looked at the French paradox. That suggests people in France have a low incidence of heart disease even though they eat a diet high in cholesterol and fat. That's been attributed to the fact that they drink red wine, which is high in resveratrol. So, The researchers looked at nearly 800 older men and women in Italy to see if resveratrol from diet was associated with cancer, heart disease, inflammation, and death. They found no, it wasn't. They say their study suggests dietary resveratrol from Western diets in older adults does not have a big influence on inflammation, cardiovascular disease, cancer, or longevity. And that's a look at headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. I'm Vivian Williams. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back. Information you want from specialists who know, hear it and live it or prevent it.
Oh, yeah.
This week's topic is stroke.
You can listen to us on air, online, or on iHeartRadio. Go to iHeartRadio and you can listen to the show 24 hours a day if you want, Tom.
Over and over.
That's right. Time for you to join our conversation. Contact us at 507-282-1234. Leave questions at our website at radio.mayoclinic.org or tweet us your questions at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio.
All right. Myth or matter of fact, there is nothing you can do to prevent a stroke.
That's a myth. There are several key risk factors for stroke, including high blood pressure, cigarette smoking, diabetes, and high cholesterol. And then other factors as well, such as a sedentary lifestyle, not getting any exercise, obesity, heavy alcohol use. Those are all risk factors as well. So there are many factors that we can alter that'll markedly lower one's risk of stroke.
And it seems like the things that you can do to prevent a stroke are very similar to those things that are recommended to prevent a heart attack or anything, really.
That's exactly right. The factors that I just talked about increase the likelihood of atherosclerosis or plaque formation in the arteries. And the positive issue is if you treat one of these risk factors, you'll lessen the risk of plaque, not only lessen the risk in one of the brain or neck arteries, but you'll lessen the risk of it forming in a heart artery or any place in the body. So these are very positive factors.
You know, we know there's an epidemic of diabetes in this country, and it seems like close to half of the people who show up in the emergency room with a heart attack have diabetes. Is that true for strokes also?
Well, high blood pressure and cigarette smoking are actually slightly more powerful risk factors for stroke than is diabetes, but it is still one of the big four risk factors, and so it is an important issue.
One of the things we want to make sure that we hammer home is the warning signs of a stroke. And I think that as the years go by, people are maybe becoming a little bit more aware of them. Mm-hmm. But tell me what they are and what do they have to do with the word FAST, F-A-S-T?
Okay. Well, the symptoms that a person might experience is that blood is lacking going to the brain tissue include the sudden onset of weakness of one side of the body, either the face, arm or leg, often in combination, sudden numbness on one side of the body, either face, arm or leg, sudden difficulty speaking, sudden difficulty understanding others, sudden difficulty seeing. Now, you can sense there's a trend in
sure.
what I'm saying. That is, it's the sudden difficulty doing something. And that's as the brain is lacking in blood flow and is not functioning correctly, the body and the brain stops working correctly.
Okay.
How about unsteadiness? Very common
It is,
symptom.
Here again, sudden unsteadiness either caused by the weakness or caused by lack of blood flow to a certain area of the back part of the brain, which controls our steadiness and balance. That definitely can occur as well.
All right, phone lines are open for stroke expert Dr. Robert Brown, 507-282-1234.
And I think the patient that had called in after we'd done this show last year or the year before said he remembered you saying, the worst headache that you've ever had in your life. And that was the phrase that he wrote to us that stuck in his head so that when a week or two later he had the worst headache he'd ever had, he went in and actually was beginning to have a stroke.
Mm-hmm. And I'm glad you mentioned that. In general, headache is not a common presenting symptom for ischemic stroke,
sure.
lack of blood supply stroke, but it is a common symptom for the bleeding type of stroke. So just as you mentioned a moment ago, Tracy, and as we had talked about last year, that sudden onset of headache, unlike anything you had ever had before, that's another key factor that should prompt you to seek care.
And what did you say, 10 or 15% of strokes are the hemorrhagic or bleeding? 15%?
That's right, Tom.
We have a tweet. Sue wants to know about TIAs. What are TIAs?
Yeah, TIA, that abbreviation stands for transient ischemic attack.
Okay.
That is temporary symptoms, very similar to those that I just talked about a moment ago.
Okay.
So in other words, it's symptoms that might well precede a stroke.
Sure.
They'll last for a few minutes or a few hours. And unfortunately, because they are transient, many people will ignore them. They'll say, you know, it went away. I don't need to worry about it.
My grandparents called these spells.
Yeah.
They had a spell.
Well, and you know, you're exactly right. They're called by many different names. But the importance for our listeners is if they do have those symptoms, even if they're transient, seek emergency care, because that is a significant risk factor for a future stroke in either the days or weeks ahead.
507-282-1234. Kay is on the line. Welcome to the program. Kay, go right ahead.
I was just wondering if staying very hydrated by drinking a lot of water, if that keeps the blood thinner and helps prevent a stroke. And then I have a follow-up question as well.
Yeah, good question.
Yeah, thank you, Kay. You know, the body does regulate the fluid so well that even if a person does take in a considerable amount of fluid, it really doesn't dilute, if you will, the various clotting factors in the system. And so no problem with remaining well hydrated. And in fact, if we do have warm weather coming up here at some point here in the upper Midwest, it does, all kidding aside, it is important to remain hydrated in that setting. So I think it is a good point.
But it doesn't really affect.
You're right. It doesn't really affect. When a person does come in with a stroke, though, via intravenous fluids, we do try to keep our patients very well hydrated, in part for the reason that you were getting at with your excellent question.
Oh, the other question I have is I am at a risk for a stroke, and I know that, and I've been told that by the clinic. And I declined having the MRI. Because I really didn't want to know at that point. Mm-hmm. You know, my mother died of a brain aneurysm that just burst, and she died within a matter of a couple of hours.
Mm.
And
well, you don't want to do that, though, do you?
Yes, I have some risk factors. But anyway, what I was, if you do find one of these aneurysms that you can close off, mm-hmm. what is the risk factors for that kind of surgery, like putting in a stent in the brain?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Well, I'm certainly sorry to hear that your mother had passed away from an aneurysm bleed. And if a person is detected to have a brain aneurysm, then as we alluded to a little earlier, we carefully consider whether that aneurysm needs to be treated. And sometimes if there has been a family history, we might be more inclined to treat it. There are the several treatment options that Dr. Miller had mentioned, including a surgical treatment. And then we do have some non-surgical treatments that Dr. Miller had alluded to as well. The risks of those treatments vary greatly on where the aneurysm is, the overall size of the aneurysm. But for a relatively small aneurysm, and that's the most common ones that we detect, for a small aneurysm in the typical locations, actually the risks of treatment are quite low. And would likely be lower than the risk of bleeding if the aneurysm was there untreated when in the setting of a family history like you're talking about.
So because there has been development and treatments, this might be a conversation that Kay wants to revisit with her
right.
physician.
Yeah, and
I'm thinking of revisiting it.
Yes.
If you have another problem I have is I bleed easily. If I carry in a bag of groceries, I'll get two or three bleeds across my hand, mm-hmm. and I put some ice on it and it goes away. But mm-hmm. Does that mean my arteries are?
Yeah, not necessarily. Now, okay, I might ask, are you on any medicines that put you at risk of bleeding, aspirin or any other medicines?
No.
Okay. Well, some people do have a slightly increased propensity to bleeding, and do mention that to your provider, because if an aneurysm treatment is being considered, they might do a couple of blood tests before the procedure to define if you have any bleeding tendency at all. And so that can be quickly clarified with some straightforward blood tests.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, Kay, and you sound very young. I think you should reconsider that MRI scan.
My doctor did say to me that he would do it if it was him.
Wow.
But I, at the time, and he said, why are you declining? And I said, you know, I just don't want to know at this point.
Yeah.
Well, Kay, thank you for calling. Those are excellent points that you have brought up.
All right, thank you.
And really something that lots of patients struggle with. You know, how much do we want to know about, as research goes on, you know, where do you want to be?
Mm-hmm. Well, for many people, whether it be aneurysms or other disorders, once you know about it, mm-hmm. then one's stress level can significantly
sure.
increase. And then when you're faced with a tough decision regarding treatment. So I can appreciate her concern.
Dr. Brown-Mither, matter of fact, I'm too young for a stroke.
Sadly, no one is too young for a stroke. We'll see
like
strokes occurring.
Even?
It just absolutely can occur in children. Fortunately, very low occurrence, but in teenagers, but people in their 20s and beyond definitely can have strokes.
For different reasons, though, I would assume, than elderly.
Yeah. In elderly patients, far and away, the most common cause is atherosclerosis or plaque formation in the artery. Certain cardiac conditions or abnormal rhythms of the heart, whereas in younger people, they're very different causes. Certain abnormalities in the artery can occur in the young. Recreational drug use, sadly, can cause strokes as well. But yeah, there are very different causes of stroke in the young.
All right, 507-282-1234. Phone lines are still open for stroke expert Dr. Robert Brown. Now, tell us about the treatment of a stroke and why it's so important. If you have any of the symptoms that you described, you get to the emergency room or a stroke center as soon as possible.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was a landmark research study that was published in the late 1990s that defined that a clot-dissolving therapy called tissue plasminogen activator could be
TPA.
Used, TPA,
yeah.
Could be this clot buster, could be used very soon after the onset of symptoms and could markedly improve a patient's outcome. And so that is now part of a standard of care. But the key issue is we need to use that clot buster very quickly after the onset of symptoms. The faster, the better. It is FDA approved up to 3 hours after onset of symptoms. And in fact, there are now new research studies that suggest we can use it up to 4.5 hours after onset. But the sooner we use it, the more likely you are going to have a good outcome.
And the reason being is that if you can restore flow within 3 to 4 hours, you can the brain cells will not die.
Mm-hmm.
But if you wait too long, the blood supply is cut off long enough that the brain cells die and you cannot recover. Those brain cells will not recover.
Well, it's amazing, Tom. Truly, every minute counts. And this is one of those disorders that is absolutely the case. Every minute that goes by, literally millions of brain cells are dying. And so the faster you can treat, the better off you're going to be.
Now, there's a stroke center here.
Mm-hmm.
So if you live in this area, you're in pretty good shape if you recognize the fact that you're having a stroke. But what if you live in East Armpit, Wyoming?
Well, I don't know specifically about that city, but I bet that city does have a hospital that has a CAT scan available that is to take a picture of the brain immediately after the patient presents. And whether the providers there are able to use clot-dissolving therapy or via what's called a telestroke connection. Now, what is a telestroke connection? Well, throughout the United States, there are networks that are popping up, if you will, where a major medical center, like Mayo Clinic, for example, will have a whole network of hospitals that can immediately contact that hub medical center and via an audio and video connection have the neurologist expert at that major medical center interact with the patient in that tiny city and be able to make a decision regarding clot-dissolving therapy. So throughout the United States and really beyond now, these networks have arisen, and we can treat patients far away from a major medical center and provide advice to them regarding treatment. So even in that little town in Wyoming, I bet they're part of a telestroke network.
And aren't you working
incredible.
On a robot that can be part of that whole telestroke program?
Absolutely, and you can remotely control it via a little device on your laptop computer. It's really quite straightforward, but we can, via our telestroke network here in the upper Midwest, we can see patients several hours away, interact with them directly and with their family members, and make advice regarding best treatment.
Now, you've talked about the symptoms, we've talked about the treatment, we've talked about the importance of time, but go over it so people can remember, take away something from this show, our listeners, the FAST acronym, FAST.
Yeah, and what that stands for is face, arm, speech, and time. What are we getting at there? Well, when it comes to face, drooping of one side of the face, facial weakness is one of the common presenting signs of stroke. Arm is if a person can't raise both arms equally, there may well be some weakness in one of the arms. Speech, do they have slurred speech? Common presenting symptom.
Or unable to speak?
Or unable to speak. Okay. Exactly right, Tracy. And then time. The faster you can be treated, the better. Call 911, seek emergency medical care. So again, FAST is face, arm, speech, and time.
What about aspirin treatment? You know, it's recommended, I think, in general by most cardiologists that if you think you're having a heart attack, you take an aspirin, because almost all of those are ischemic type, where the artery that supplies blood to the heart is plugged up. What about for stroke? Because you've got this group of people where it's actually a hemorrhagic stroke and the aspirin might make it worse.
Yeah, it's a great point, Tom. And that's the key difference between heart attack and stroke overall. Not all strokes are due to ischemic disease or lack of blood flow, but about 85% or so are. So if you have the onset of one of those symptoms that we discussed a few minutes ago, it's reasonable to go ahead, take an aspirin while you've also dialed 911 and you're seeking emergency medical care. Even if it is a bleeding type of stroke, the likelihood that you're going to worsen that by having taken that aspirin emergently is very low. And if it's one of those 80 to 90% of strokes where there is a lack of blood supply, you will maybe have done a good thing.
So in general, you would recommend
it? I would.
A myth or matter of fact that I think is particularly important. Women die of strokes more often than men. Yeah. Is that a myth or a fact?
Well, it's true. Stroke is a very important issue, both in men and in women. There was recently a very highly publicized guideline by the American Heart Association, American Stroke Association, regarding stroke prevention in women. And so it's a very important issue, both in men and in women.
All right, we've got a couple of minutes left. I think there's another caller back to line one.
We'll see if we can grab them. Good morning. Welcome to KRDC. Do you have a question for us?
I may have missed a short portion of your program, but do first responders carry the clot-busting drug? Is that something that would speed treatment? You know, can they be sure enough communicating with ER doctors that they're dealing with a stroke?
And great.
Yeah. Boy, that is a great, great question. And the short answer to your question is no, they don't carry that clot-dissolving therapy. And the reason for that is we need to obtain a picture of the brain tissue called a CAT scan prior to giving the TPA. The reason for that is the potential for a bleeding type of stroke. And so if there is a bleeding type of stroke, the last thing one wants to do is give a clot-dissolving therapy. So we have to have the CAT scan first before making that decision.
That is a great question, though. Thanks for your call. So, Dr. Robert Brown, it's always great to have you on the program. And the one thing we want to remind our listeners before we leave is the FAST acronym. Quickly, once more, what does that stand for?
Yeah, the FACE acronym, FACE, meaning facial weakness. Arm, A is arm for arm weakness, S speech or speech slurring, and time. Every minute counts. Seek emergency medical care if you have the onset of symptoms.
Dr. Robert Brown, who is chairman of the Department of Neurology, Mayo Clinic, Rochester, thanks again for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much for the invitation.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Coming up, we'll tell you about next week's program. Welcome back. Next week on Mayo Clinic Radio, we'll go out of this world with two Mayo aeronautical experts, Dr. Jan Stepanek and Dr. Abba Zubair.
Yes.
You know, and I'm going to be gone, so well, Dr. Sanj Kakkar will be sitting
in
for me.
Yes, Dr. Zubair is at Mayo Clinic Florida, and he is working on a project that is going to send stem cells into space about the International Space Station, because they can do things in space that they can't do on ground. And we're going to hear a little bit more about that program. And Dr. Jan Stepanek is at Mayo Clinic, Arizona, and he's part of the aerospace medicine program. They do all things from recreational and professional pilots all the way up to helping individuals who want to climb Mount Everest. So all these different things that have to do with altitude. And of course, we've heard how historically Mayo Clinic has helped with the development of the G-suit, just all these different things.
You know, it's very true that Mayo has had a big part in the aeronautics and what goes on in the air, and has helped in so many ways, the government in this country. And this is an ongoing effort. It'll be interesting to talk to both of them. Looking forward to it.
That's right. We hope you'll join us. For more information on topics discussed on this program and more information about strokes, you can go to mayoclinic.com. radioclinic.com, or our website is radio.mayoclinic.org, where you'll be able to access a podcast of today's program, as well as a story about using the measles vaccine to cure cancer.
What a great story. You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our senior producer, Ron Petrovich, our associate producer and phone screener, Audrey Kesseltine, our technical director, Kim David. Our theme music was written and performed by Chip Davis of Mannheim Steamroller. For Mayo Clinic Radio and Dr. Robert Brown, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCrae.
Thanks for being with us.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.